outside and at the bottom of the ladder. How Mormon Studies Looks to a Non-LDS Young Scholar. A presentation by Seth Perry with a response by Dan Weatherspoon.
Before we begin, I'd like to just remind everybody to turn off any noisemakers you might have, cell phones, pagers, if those are still in use. I'd like to welcome everybody out to session number 5, Outside and at the Bottom of the Ladder, How Mormon Studies Looks to a Non-LDS Young Scholar. I just wanted to start off by introducing Seth Perry. Seth Perry received his bachelor's degree from Georgetown University in 2001 and a Master of Arts in Religious Studies from the University of Chicago Divinity School in 2004. He expects to finish his PhD at the Divinity School in 2008. Seth's current primary research interest is Joseph Smith's translation of the Bible. He has written for the Chronicle of Higher Education Review and the Divinity School's Sightings Newsletter, which reflection was printed in the December 2005 Sunstone. Seth was raised on a small farm in central Ohio. He's getting married in August to Stephanie Jose, his best friend of 8 years. Responding to him will be our own Dan Weatherspoon, editor of Sunstone Magazine and the executive director of Sunstone Education Foundation. We are on the side of his alma mater. He got his PhD in religion here at Claremont Graduate University with an emphasis in philosophy of religion and theology in 1996. He's married for 20 years to Lori Hubbard Weatherspoon, and they have 2 children, Alex, age 18, and Hope, age 12. Seth?
Morning. People often assume I'm Mormon. I study Mormonism. As a vanilla white, clean-cut Midwesterner, I fit pretty well into the average person's mental picture of what a Mormon looks like. The response I get when I explain that my interest is purely academic and accidental, I really did just stumble onto the right book at the right time, depends on the person I'm talking to. Both non-Mormons and Mormons are intrigued, the former by Mormonism, the latter by my interest. Non-Mormons often become conspiratorial, ready to get answers to everything they've always wanted to know about Mormonism but were afraid to ask. Mormons, on the other hand, always take an interest in my interest and often make an opposite and equally misguided assumption that it suggests an inkling toward conversion, or at least a desire to celebrate the faith from the outside. Rare is someone who assumes an unvarnished academic interest. From where I stand, as a young scholar looking to get into the field, the challenges presented in these everyday conversations, generally the skepticism of outsiders and the faith promotion of members, are miniature versions of those endemic to the professional field of Mormon studies. They signal some of the questions of method and audience which loom large for a non-Mormon just starting out in the field. What I want to do here is elaborate my take on the perils of those two audiences and offer some thoughts on the ways in which I think my scholarship and that of others is likely to respond to those challenges. I came upon Mormonism as an undergraduate when I was looking for a subject in American religious history for a senior thesis. The first serious book I read on the subject was Fawn Brody's biography of Joseph Smith, No Man Knows My History, which is, of course, widely recognized as an abysmal piece of historiography. It is, however, a pretty piece of writing, and I was hooked on the story Brody told. Peeling away the eccentricities of her book and of so many others, one recognizes that the Mormon story needs no embellishment, that the facts of Joseph Smith's life and the subsequent development, the religion he created, are compelling enough as they stand. So I wrote my senior thesis on Joseph's revision of the Bible. My undergraduate department didn't have anyone specializing in Mormonism, nor anyone really in American religious history, but my readers did their best and took an interest. All copies of the thesis itself have hopefully been destroyed. I decided senior year that I wanted to be a religious studies major who actually did something specific with it, so I applied to the University of Chicago Divinity School, took a year off to work, enrolled a few years ago. I finished the master's degree, and I'm 2 years into the PhD. I'll be taking doctoral exams in the fall, and I've been telling my increasingly confused parents that is, I am 2 years from a doctorate, ideally less than that, from some sort of full-time employment. I've chosen to specialize in Mormon studies rather than merely dabble because I like it, and I think the subject is large enough to support extended, concentrated study. My advisor dutifully reminds me, though, that if I expect to find a job, I need to assimilate my primary interest into the broader study of Christianity or of religion in America, since it may be a long, long time before a teaching position explicitly in Mormon studies will be available to an entry-level non-Mormon. So if I am hired, before the fact, it's always better to talk about these things as possibilities, I will most likely show up on a faculty website with American religious history somewhere under my name. Everyone recognizes that phrase as problematic. What does that mean, really? The religious character of an arbitrary geographical area, of a political entity, of a population drawn from all over the world. We all know what it means functionally, though. When it manifests as a textbook, it generally has something about Native Americans at the front, something about John Kennedy and Pat Robertson at the end, and an awful lot about Catholic and Protestant Christians in the middle. Also in the middle, there's a chapter about the other ones, the Shakers, Christian Science, and the Mormons. And given my doctoral exams in the history of Christianity and my original research in Mormonism, I'd be qualified to teach a class labeled American Religious History. I'm being a little flippant about that, but if you're on a hiring committee, I am dead serious. I would be perfect to teach that class. However it works out, this class is not my ideal, because it would force me to insert Mormonism into a larger study, and that's something that I think is still very difficult. The reasons why it's difficult have to do with what I've flagged here as the voyeuristic tendencies of outsiders. If I've learned anything about presenting Mormonism to those unfamiliar with it, it's that proper presentation requires time and effort if it is not to devolve into a handful of catchphrases which are themselves misunderstood and misappropriated as examples of oddity and deviance. This is perhaps true of explaining anything, particularly any religion. Students of non-Western religions have long dealt with this sort of essentializing or orientalizing and are profoundly sensitive to it. In my experience, though, the degree of sensitivity in discussions of religion, and this certainly includes academic discussions, is proportional to a religion's distance from Christianity and Judaism, the de facto points of reference for the vast majority of scholars, students, and random encounters I'm likely to deal with. Excuse me. It seems easier to approach different religious points of view when they are different on the scale of humanity, rather than only on the scale of one's own faith or environment. The very different speaks to the experiences of an alien history and culture, while the sort of different appears to some merely as an odd arrangement of the features of a world they know well. In my experience, the fact that Buddhism is essentially atheistic causes less consternation than the fact that Latter-day Saints believe in God but believe that he has a body. Because of such incongruities between what people assume about Christian doctrine and some of the teachings of Mormonism, a number of people I've talked to do not intuitively place Mormonism among the other things they evaluate as religions. I've come to this conclusion based on my own experiences talking to fellow non-Mormons informally about the church. Over the course of several years now, I've reflected at length on the telling people what I do exchange. I've been fine-tuning my technique, and I think I can say that I'm finally beginning to get better at it. Again, elaborating this faith tactfully to the uninitiated takes time, more time than a standard dinner or cocktail conversation is likely to lend, and I have discovered over time that the details which I find most interesting only serve to confuse people and ultimately leave them with something other than the benign view of the church I frankly want them to walk away with. At the point I'm at now, I allow myself to be guided almost entirely by the questions I'm asked. When asked what I do, I say I'm in religious studies. No, not to enter the ministry, just to study. To my approach is historical. The concept of religious studies itself is pretty obscure to people. I specialize in American religious history, specifically the LDS Church. Here the light bulb goes off, and invariably next comes the "Are you one?" question. Family members, who already know I wasn't raised Mormon, ask if I've converted. Now here, I'm guessing that my experience with outsiders is different than that of members, because people feel very free to start in with me with questions they might not ask a member right up front. I can report that there is very little of what I think we can fairly call anti-Mormon sentiment out there. Very few people, at least in the circles I move in, are openly hostile toward the faith. There is, though, less positively, commonly a note of whimsy, a little smile in the questions I get. These generally begin with money. Gosh, they sure are rich. The church sure is rich. Or something about Mormonism being the fastest growing religion in the world, something which everyone seems to have heard and believe to be very important. Or a joke about plural marriage. Often this last is something ribald directed at me. I'm engaged right now. Will Stephanie let you have another one? Something like that. Most people I talk to are well aware that the church no longer sanctions plural marriage, but they also know that some people out west where the Mormons are still practice it, and this is confusing. I've gotten pretty good at clarifying this in a way people understand. Beyond such questions, I generally try to turn the conversation around. Do they know any members of the church? Almost without fail, this results in something positive about a friend or coworker who has lots of kids, doesn't see R-rated movies, and is really, really nice. Rarely do these conversations get to theology or details about church doctrine. This is partly by design. I frankly do not want to have this talk with most people I come across. And that's because I rarely feel like I have enough time to introduce both the history and the doctrine, field relevant questions, and leave a person with the view of Mormonism I want them to have, that of a religion just like any other religion. When you explain golden plates and eternal progression quickly, it's bound to sound just strange. Again, this is somewhat different for me than I suspect it is for a member, first because of the absence of restraint my non-membership grants to the person I'm talking to, and secondly, because I have to do it in the third person. I don't have any immediate evidence at hand. If I were a Mormon describing my faith, the person I'm talking to would see in me that normal, thoughtful people believe in the religion being described. Hopefully they would see me as normal and thoughtful, and take at least that much with them. These conversations are difficult even among my fellow graduate students, a group that is supposed to be good at abstracting this sort of thing. A Jewish friend of mine once began berating me. That's another interesting part of being an outsider interested in the church, is that I often find myself in the odd position of representing it, about the LDS conception of the office of prophet being set on what she regarded as a misappropriation of the Hebrew Bible's concept of a prophet. I stumbled in discussing Kolob with someone the other day and got the "gosh, it's so weird" line, which always leaves me resorting to the "well, it's no weirder than anything else" defense, which I admit is not ideal. It works well in this case. It worked well in this case. My friend started listing elements of her own tradition that she felt hesitant to describe to outsiders because she knew that they sounded weird. I don't require that people take the same view of Mormonism I have, but I have failed if someone leaves a conversation with me dismissing Mormonism out of hand simply because its fantastic-sounding foundation story lacks the sanctifying mist of a few hundred centuries. The professional lesson for me from these experiences is that I always have to be mindful of the situation I'm in, how I'm being heard and by whom when I talk about my chosen subject. I need to be mindful to set the right tone with scholars in other fields for whom I'd like to write, with students I'd like to teach. Going back to the idea of a class on American religious history, the most likely place where I will be doing this in a classroom setting, when including the Mormon story in a religious history meant for people who are not specialists in Mormonism or in religion generally, the comparative strangeness of the story must be taken into account. I in no way mean strange in a pejorative sense, of course. This is just an observation that the events of the beginning of the church and the doctrine which Joseph developed stand out among the banal denominational squabbles which make up so much of what is covered under American religious history. And anyway, the charge of strangeness is certainly no insult to faith. Joseph himself found truth in proving contraries, and Martin Luther taught that truth had to be completely against reason. The Mormon story, even if told as enthusiastically, let alone as objectively, as possible, will always have an element of strangeness when set in the context of American religious history. The even-handed telling of strange stories, by which all religions are explained, of course, is a challenge to which all academic writing on religion is heir. The problem is made worse when we're talking about putting Mormonism in the context of American religious history by the fact that this particular originating story is being told within a circumscribed larger narrative defined by previously existing religions, whose comparably odd stories don't need to be told in this context. And even if they were, could be expected to enjoy some existing level of acceptance among the audience. For any brief account for non-specialists, my goal should be to do as little as possible to assign value to that strangeness and to contextualize it whenever possible by drawing connections to more familiar parts of American religious history. These connections for me include elements like a reliance on the King James Bible, shared with American Protestants, and an optimistic doctrine of salvation that, like Methodism, for example, moved away from the Calvinist tendencies of earlier generations. It is a challenge to accomplish this task without obscuring precisely the characteristics which have defined Mormonism and which make it interesting to me. Another serious challenge is that an incredibly fine line separates knowingly sculpting an account to mitigate the strangeness and overtly sympathizing, needless to say, apologizing. In addition to being contrary to what I think are the basic goals of scholarship, I do not think apology is necessary in an academic context. Apologetics assumes that the opinion of the audience to whom it is aimed matters in some definitive way. Justin Martyr, one of the earliest Christian apologists, was, after all, ostensibly writing to an emperor and a Roman populace who had the power of life and death over Christians. The audiences for my scholarship will have no such power. And while I want them to have positive or neutral thoughts about the Mormonism, I don't think that the integrity of the subject is harmed if they don't. More to the point, I don't think my own interest as an outsider validates Mormonism in some way. That's not my goal, nor something that needs to be done. At the very least, 12 million members validate the church. I just string words together. This brings me to my encounters with members of the church, where I've sometimes felt that validation is part of what people see in my interest. This sort of thing was writ large at the Worlds of Joseph Smith Conference at the Library of Congress almost exactly a year ago. Throughout the conference, there was a sense that Joseph Smith's legacy was somehow being validated by this meeting at the Library of Congress, by the fact that a secular institution of the government that had once declined to help him was celebrating him on the bicentennial of his birth. I understand this impulse, but this is a functionalist view of scholarship that ultimately causes problems. Scholarship as validation is a dangerous position because it evinces an anticipation of quote-unquote positive conclusions, which are bound to be sometimes disappointed. The reverse of the question of what members expect from me is what do I expect from them? And this is also confounding. This talk is adapted from an article of mine that ran in the Chronicle of Higher Education's Review in January. Far and away, the most common response I got to that piece was what I've come to respectfully call the John Welch question. Most of my responses came from thoughtful, believing members of the church who were pleased by my interest and asked, "What can we do to help you? How can we assist you in your work?" I've heard Dr. Welch ask this question in public forums on more than one occasion. I have no intention of finding fault with it here. I believe that it is the sincere expression of thoughtful people who really do want to be helpful. But I don't have the slightest idea how to answer it. The answer is not, can never be, nothing. And yet I've had experiences that have left me ashamed to discover nothing as my knee-jerk response. Chief among these was the last session of the Worlds of Joseph Smith Conference. It was that day at the conference that I saw for the first time open condescension from a member toward an interested non-member. Although the conference was subtitled an International Academic Conference, by the end it was very difficult to be sure whom that self-conscious reminder was supposed to convince, as apologetic works shared the stage with academic papers. At the last session, Douglas J. Davies of the University of Durham, one of the most prominent non-Mormon scholars of Mormonism, presented an extremely technical and wonderful paper on the prospects for the church's future international growth. His thesis, drawn from his more general theoretical work on how religions become world religions, was that as Mormonism grows, it will accommodate and adapt to the cultures it encounters. Otherwise, it will never really be a world religion, in his technical definition. The last respondent, not coincidentally, I feel confident, slated as the last speaker at the last session on the last day, given the very last word, thanked Davies for his interest, but informed him that as an outsider, there were some things he'd have trouble understanding. He then proceeded to savage Davies' paper on the basis of the fact that, as a divinely instituted authority, the church would not be affected by the cultures in which it grows because of the singularity of its revealed truth. At the end of the session, Davies asked the audience what I have been wondering throughout the conference. What are we doing here? What was this conference about? Is it academic or is it evangelistic? Davies' question hit the nail on the head. I have every respect for evangelistic scholarship or apologetics or whatever we want to call it. I understand the need for some to respond to anti-Mormon polemic, and I'm certain that that response has its place. I just don't think that that place is on stage next to Douglas Davies. No conference is academic where scholars like Davies are expected to share the stage with members of the church ready to give wholly faith-based arguments about why he is wrong. It's my hope that just about everyone on all sides recognizes that some of what happened there was unfortunate and that most would recognize that it was probably anomalous. I'll grant that it's an extreme manifestation of what is nonetheless a commonplace discomfort. This problem is different from that in other areas of religious studies, where member scholars are also the rule. In the broader study of Christianity, for example, the identification of scholar with subject can often be carried down to the denomination in which a researcher specializes. A large number of people who study liberal American Protestantism are liberal American Protestants. And the Mormon scholars who lead the field of Mormon studies are mindful of the issues that arise at the intersections of faith and scholarship, and they certainly don't need me to praise them. The problem is not that Mormons want to be part of the academic study of their faith, but that their church, the definitive insider, wants to be part of it. This goes back to the point about scholarship as validation, the church seems to see scholarship as giving credence to the world religions and Christian bodies among which it wants to be counted. And so it pursues scholarship with this goal of validation in mind. The result is that where the church has had influence, the tone of scholarship engaging those outside the faith has sometimes been defensive and hortatory, seeking to display the religion to outsiders rather than engage them in academic discussion of it. Scholarship as validation is seen in some circles as the answer to the problem of voyeurism I've outlined above. I believe, however, that just the opposite is true. I think that the urge to bring faith-reliant scholarship into academic conversations is isolating, and that it plays into the ghettoizing of this discipline by letting outsiders assume that this study is still by Mormons for Mormons. It discourages the comparative work and even-handed, non-polemical elaborations of the faith that I think are the only workable answers to the problem of voyeurism, which I should also make clear I don't think is ultimately completely solvable. Voyeurism is inherent in all study. Where the church has affected, and in some ways even set, the agenda for scholarship, it has cultivated a certain tone and set of habits. Perhaps chief among these is the wholesale bracketing of truth claims. I have no interest in challenging the faith of the faithful, but as a secular historian, I also have no interest in writing about historical events as if I believed or felt indifferent to the divine causes which believers may ascribe to them. I am not a Mormon. I am an outsider. What that means for me as a scholar is that when I talk about Joseph Smith's work on the King James Bible, I call it a revision, not a translation. Joseph did not translate the Bible because he did not read Greek and did not work from the Greek texts. This is what scholars in other fields expect me to say as a matter of course. In a draft of a paper I submitted to my advisor recently, I spent 2 pages explaining why I said revision instead of translation, and she was confused by that. What not being a believer means is that when I consider the summer of 1828, when the first 116 pages of the Book of Mormon were lost, I do not see Joseph as a repentant prophet being chastised by God. I see a struggling artist, angry and frustrated by circumstances. If you were in the last session with the South Park, when Lucy Harris got smart, apparently, was the argument there. This does not mean that I don't find faithful scholarship useful or interesting. It does mean that I am bound to find it limited, just as believers may find my work limited for being devoid of faith. I think that the difficult fact, though, perhaps more awkward for me to articulate, because it is easy for me to say, so to speak, is that the onus is on faithful scholarship, or whatever we want to call it, to make its case to what is called naturalism for belonging in the academy, and not the other way around. As a non-believer, I promise respect, and I promise fairness. I ask for clarification at times. I ask for access to primary documents at times. I ask for input at times, but I do not ask for agreement or indulgence, and I do not ask for permission. In turn, I fully anticipate and respect the right of the church and its members to deny me all of those, believers, but it would be dishonest of me, and against what I consider a scholar to be, for me to say that at the end of the day, that was a primary concern. I want to be unambiguous here about my belief that the future of Mormon studies looks more like me and like those who will take faithful than like those who will take faithful exception to my arguments. This shift is going to happen because the audience for Mormon studies is going to grow as the church does. Sermonizing under the guise of scholarly discussion is not interesting to the growing number of scholars, non-Mormon and Mormon, specialist and non-specialist, who expect academic discussion of these subjects uninterrupted by arguments from faith in which everyone cannot share. I am not interested in apologetics any more than I am interested in anti-Mormon polemic. I do hope that when the definitive split happens, things will not turn adversarial. The sad truth is that many see discussion of the faith from the stance I will take synonymous with trying to tear it down, which is just not the case. I have nothing but respect for a faith that, from my purely academic standpoint, undeniably brings joy and solace to countless lives. I said a lot here about aspirations to academic objectivity and the ideal even-handedness that I would work toward. The fact is that, as everyone knows, objectivity is a myth. I am hopelessly devoted to Joseph Smith in my own way. I struggle constantly against letting that bias come through. Within the bounds I've set for myself, I support and defend the church she founded. My devotion is a form of Fawn Brodie's, though, who gushed at the end of her book about Joseph's theology becoming in his hands a thing of color, warmth, and originality, but had stopped believing that it had been divinely inspired. I think that the non-believers who will be seeking scholarship about the church as its presence grows in the coming years need to be talked to in this tone, that of the sympathetic outsider, that they might gain an understanding of the church, its founders, and its members, which assumes Mormonism as an important contemporary and historical reality, manifestly worthy of honest, fair study, and seeking validation from no one. Thank you.
Seth is a non-Mormon. There's a spirit of discernment that you lack. And I want you to know that your interest in Mormonism, I as a Latter-day Saint, know that that's really the Holy Ghost whispering to you. And, you know, throughout history, whenever God's wanted to communicate with children, he's done so through prophets. And I'll give you the first discussion afterwards. So, anyway, welcome, Seth, to our discussion. How can I help you? No, and I mean this in a great way. When I came across Seth's piece from the sightings that we published in the last magazine, I said, this is somebody to watch. This is a sharp person who, it'll be great for our discussion to have, and I'm hoping all that you recognize that he has some very insightful things to say, and I really think that he's parsed many of these issues just dead on. And I'll echo some of those as we talk a little bit here. But again, welcome. Thrilled to have you. Thanks for coming out. In some ways, I'm friends with Jan Shipps. I'm also friends with David Ray Griffin, and they both share something in that every time Jan Shipps is in everybody's Rolodex as the person to talk to about Mormonism. So if you're not careful, you'll end up in that role. And I just wanted to have you warn Stephanie that apparently what happens is she gets the call, and her husband Tony knows that the next 45 minutes is basically her having to teach the reporter basically the history and doctrine of Mormonism before she could even begin to address the question. And so you're heading into it. And David Ray Griffin was my advisor here at Claremont, where I studied process theology, and a couple of process guys here. I was just every time I'd read something from David, I would have to go through 30 pages of explanation of process theology for him to get to the point that he wanted to make. And I would ask him, and he just goes, it just comes with the territory of sort of having a metaphysic and something you have to lay out before you do positive. So thank you for at least at this point being willing to take that on, because we do need some great translators for us, and I'm really excited about you. And again, when those phone calls come, if you get in those Rolodexes, make sure it's in the vows that you guys take, better or worse, long phone calls. Yeah. One just thing before I get into the substantive part, I did want to echo my own experience in graduate school with talking about Mormonism, with what Seth says, and that there really isn't a hostility in academic circles to LDS ideas. What I found is that as I would speak up and I'd say, you know, the LDS church has an interesting angle of approach on this, people would just be interested. And it was shocking to them that this conservative, Republican church, which is all they had, actually had a theology and the way the universe is put together and a sense of humans and this intelligences, whatever it was that was, they were just shocked for it. And so I'm glad that that's been your experience at Chicago too. Certainly here at Claremont, Mary Ellen, same thing. Lay it out there. Nobody's trying to bash us. Right, just this is they're very interested and happy to have Mormons join the conversation. So I wanted to echo that there. Okay, I think the shift that Seth talks about occurring has occurred, it will occur, and I do think right now the church is in this scholarship as validation mode. I was at a panel discussion at BYU probably a month ago where they did a deconstruct. It was to celebrate the publication of the proceedings of the Library of Congress thing. And so they had a panel that involved quite a few of the people that were involved in planning that thing. And one of the things that Richard Bushman said there was quite interesting. He says, Mormons are just now getting used to actually putting their beliefs in argument form. He says, typically, if you talk to somebody and you're speaking confessional language, you'll get a polite response. because it's your confession. Like you even shared a little bit here that, you know, you don't get quite the polite response because you're not a Mormon, whereas we would get a polite hearing if we were giving it confessionally. He says, we're just now in the last few years beginning to put our positions in argument form, and guess what? We're going to get less polite responses. Because when you put your stuff in argument form, you're going to get arguments back about why this works and doesn't work. And so he called it, he says, when a religion gets uppity, that was his words, and actually decides to argue for its positions instead of just declare them, that's a moment. And he says right now his sense is that it's going to be a little transition time for Latter-day Saints to be used to having their arguments actually taken as arguments and critiqued as arguments. And so when you're speaking confessionally, you will get people who have strong other confessions who will be that anti-Mormon, you know, kind of, you guys are terrible. But now scholars are going to start hearing our positions in these argumentation forums, and we need to watch for it. And he thinks that it's ultimately, obviously, a very good thing. And Robert Millett was there, too, and also echoed. He says, yes, it's fine. And Robert Millett's apparently meeting with general authorities and kind of getting used to it. But he says that they're on board for this. On the other hand, the business about the church looking for validation through scholarship is happening. And I agree with you that it can't be much longer. I think that moment will come and go. And I agree with that. But I wanted to tell two stories, though, to share that this really is a shift. One story I'm going to have to give you just kind of I know I heard the story. I'm giving you the facts as I heard them, but I tried to call my source. I only got Seth's paper as I was driving down here, so I tried to call my source to validate it. But this is a change for the church. When Gerald Jones was at the Graduate Theological Union Institute, apparently, the Graduate Theological Union at Berkeley, does everybody know what that is? It's basically a bunch of centers from different religions that get together and students can cross-register and all that stuff and study the different religions. Well, he was approached just to say, you know, we know you have this LDS thing. Would we want to do some exploratory discussions about having Mormonism join the union, having the Institute become that? And Gerald Jones, PhD, philosopher, really interested. He was the right guy to be there at Berkeley at the time. And he was very excited about the possibility of this. He knew it was a shift for the church to do that. But as soon as he took it to the level, the next level up, apparently what happened is they immediately came back and they said, no, we don't want our students subjected to having our religion talked about in that way. We wouldn't want them to ever take, you know, classes from other religions. In other words, our institutes and things are for our people, etc. And so that little flirtation, I don't know how serious it was or if it would have ever led anything, but it was immediately met, apparently, with this, sorry. Now, the other one I had personal experience with that represents, this was about in 1991. It was while I was here at Claremont. A friend of mine and I, we'd been attending the American Academy of Religion every year, and it was just crazy that of all the sessions that they have there, that there is no section on Mormon studies. You know, so we decided as energetic grad students who enjoyed the AAR that we'd like to see about getting continuing status at the AAR. Well, one of the requirements there is that you get a list of 25 scholars, I think it was 25 or 30 scholars, who agree to support your session. In other words, they kind of sign something that says, we'd be willing to submit papers, we'll be willing to attend this and stuff. So kind of in our little circle of friends, we thought of 8 or 9 people who we knew were members of the AAR, and we kind of started contacting them. And then we got the idea, well, let's talk to so-and-so, and I won't name his name. And he's not at all. He was a good friend in this process, but it was an interesting answer that happened. So we went to him, who had a prominent role in a church circles, but we also knew that he was an academic and kind of did conference things. And we asked him to get involved with, you know, maybe using your position to co-opt or to encourage some other people to join in our little effort to get continuing status at the AAR. And he goes, okay, yeah, maybe I can do that. But before he felt like in his official role that he could make an announcement, he'd had to talk to the people upstairs with his job. And immediately he got the answer, No, we don't want a session at the AAR. That will only give another opportunity for people to make fun of us. In other words, that will only give an opportunity for our critics to take us. So the church, within the last 15 years, at least the people at that next level up, only saw scholarship as dangerous, as only, you know, only bad things could come to have our traditions done. And so that's definitely a shift. And I think Seth is right that they're right now they are basking in the glow of Library of Congress. They are excited that the chair here at Claremont is happening. They sort of see this as validating, but I agree that it will pass. And just my final point is, from what I understand of how the chair at Claremont is working, as far as the negotiations with the council, the people who are raising the money, the school here, the school has done exactly what they should do, and that is make it clear, we are hiring a colleague. We are hiring a faculty member here at CGU. You do not choose the scholar that will come and sit in this Howard W. Hunter chair. We will choose it. We'll go through our processes, etc. We're gratified and grateful that you have interest in raising the money. Thank you. We're endowment. We're all for this. But we're going to do it. And so hopefully the integrity of the process here, if there's similar integrity at the process at Utah State, which is about to announce. And again, as things go on, I think we're in good shape. And through this little feeling out period that Bushman was talking about and stuff like that, I think the church will settle down. And hopefully it won't appear that Mormon Studies is only by Mormons, for Mormons, and I hope that'll pass. So those are just my little thoughts to hopefully have a great discussion. So thank you.
Okay, we have about 20 minutes for questions. Let me see. I think I can. I'll bring this over here. So you'll use both microphones. If you can just, I guess you're welcome to come up, or if you guys want to repeat the question into the microphones.
That's fine. Would you consider, well, actually, before I ask the question, let me give a little bit of background. It seems to me that there is a big difference take anthropology or sociology. Actually, I'll take sociology as a better example. Take sociology and compare it to philosophy in how they approach what they do. Sociologists have a common methodology. And when they approach a religion, they're approaching it with that methodology. Faith commitments are irrelevant to that methodology by the very nature of the methodology. However, in philosophy, which I think is a pretty well-established field in the academy, given that Plato started it and he started the academy, and central to philosophy is philosophy of religion. It's always been central to philosophy. Only in the 20th century did you find philosophers who actually didn't say, there's many philosophers who don't say anything about philosophy of religion, but before the 20th century, almost every philosopher said something about philosophy of religion. It's central to philosophy. It seems to me that you have to count philosophy of religion as part of religious studies. And if you do, philosophy of religion is inherently apologetic one way or the other. There's philosophers of religion, of course, who are atheists, like Anthony Cleveland. Well, he was atheist. He changed his mind recently, but there are philosophers of religion like Bill Rowe who are atheists, and they're going to defend that position, and they're going to argue vehemently for it. And there's philosophers of religion who are theists like Alvin Plantinga, and they're going to defend that position, and they're going to argue vehemently for it. And this doesn't happen in a vacuum. They don't decide their positions based on their arguments. They're already in a place somewhere in a religious tradition or outside of a religious tradition, and that affects where they go. Their faith commitments affect their scholarship, and it seems to me that philosophy of religion does have to count as part of religious studies, but it seems to be a counterexample to what you were saying about religious studies. Can you respond?
I'll just say, maybe I should make clear, my too loud, my too close. Oh, I'm not close enough. My approach is historical. To draw on sort of the way the curriculum is divided at Chicago, where I am, history of history of Christianity, which is my area, is divided from what would be philosophy of religion. And philosophy of religion is classified with theology and ethics. And sort of the thumbnail way of saying it, with complete respect, is that people who believe stuff are kind of over there. And that includes ethicists and philosophers of religion and theologians who are working from assumptions toward elaborating their own commitments or whatever. In history of religion, or in historical studies in religion, this is a fine distinction in Chicago. In historical studies, the difference is that might be true for a lot of people that they are believers, and I think overwhelmingly that is true in history of Christianity. But that doesn't enter into the historical studies they're doing. They're doing historical criticism, all sorts of work on the Bible and whatever else, bracketing those things for themselves if they have them. And then over here at Chicago is history of religions, which is a term that comes straight from Eliade, and that's sort of maybe what Chicago is best known for, which is where sociologists and anthropologists would be sort of working out of that together. So sort of in the middle where those things are completely possible, not relevant. And philosophy of religion, and broadly bracketed in terms of they all work in the same building in Chicago and other schools around the country, then yes, they're all part of the same thumbnail discipline. It's part of this difference from where I really see myself working. Makes sense.
Can I follow up? So, but it seems to me that it is entirely appropriate, in some sense, the term apologetics is entirely appropriate in philosophy of religion to be doing apologetics. And so that entails, if philosophy of religion really should be part of religious studies, and I think it is. I think that there are philosophy of religion papers presented at the AAR. It's not just at philosophy conferences or the Society of Christian Philosophy. If it is part of religious studies, then apologetics is part of religious studies, too.
Try to summarize these questions.
We're doing our best.
Okay. The question has been about. This is really complicated.
just leave this just one alone. You're fine. Yeah.
Okay. The question has been about the placeability of philosophy of religions, which entails apologetics, as a part of religious studies. I'm not disagreeing with you. Sure. There are those sessions at the AAR. I'm not going to them, I guess is what I'm trying to say. As an historian, where apologetics is inherent, I'm not interested. And I think that in historical studies, it's important that it not be. And basically what I would say, whether they're under the same rubric or not, what philosophers of religion and ethicists are doing is different than what I'm doing. We can all get hired in the same department or whatever else, but I don't consider myself doing the same project.
So you didn't mean that claim to apply to all religious studies then?
That apologetics has...
Because I'm just thinking of the Library of Congress thing, because some of the people there might have been thinking, well, what we're doing is...
That's a good concrete example. My point there would be that, in that session I was talking about, Douglas Davies was doing historical studies, or actually he was over here in anthropology, sociology, right?
Yeah.
And the response he got was from over here, ethics or theology, basically. And that's where that juxtaposition doesn't belong. Yeah. I guess what I'm pointing out is where that distinction at least needs to be observed. Okay, good.
Yeah, could you...
In historical studies, there's been a real problem in historians who are on the fringes or outside of the church getting access to primary documents. And now you come in quite a different perspective. The church doesn't allow some people access to important documents simply because they know they're biased. But you, as an outsider, does that affect your access to primary documents in a different way?
I'll be honest, I haven't come to that point yet. I haven't yet been not allowed to look at anything. But at the same time, my research has been very... I'm a second-year PhD student. I'm not playing in the big leagues yet. So the things that I've been looking for are sort of on a secondary level anyway. What I'm hoping to do now is sort of forge ahead optimistically.
I'll just have a comment.
And what I would want to say is that I understand that as a challenge, and I respect the right of the people who have the key to the door, to not let me in the door. So there's not much I can do about that. And part of what today is about is I'm not interested in
cozying up to get that. You know what I mean? And I understand, the consequences of that, and I respect the consequences of that with all sincerity.
Just a quick follow-up. We brought out Laurie Mathley Kipp, who's University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, as our Sunstone speaker at the big lecture we have at Sunstone last summer. And the church historian's office got wind of that, and boy, they wanted to have lunch with her. And so we arranged for Richard Turley and Marlon Jensen, who's the church historian and the head of the department. They took her to lunch, winder and dined her, postumed and dined her, whatever, you know, would be the term. But it was basically a welcome, and it was the John Welch question, how can we help you? So I would anticipate that for Seth until, you know, he screws up. You know, I wouldn't anticipate you're going to have problems. Yeah. So,
I'm always curious about
the question was about Mormon women's issues being on my radar. The answer is absolutely, if only because, well, not only because, but I wouldn't really have a choice. My advisor is Catherine Breckus of Chicago, who is, that's what she does, and she's constantly pushing me on that, so you can't really be in the same room with her for very long and not be pushed in that direction. And absolutely, I don't have any concrete examples right away, but definitely.
Well, you're not going to have access to it.
Okay.
John?
Current overall response of the LDS Church to scholarship and becoming more engaged in terms of scholarship, is it similar or dissimilar to the reaction of other sects in the past to Christianity?
So in other words, are there models from the past that...
The question was about whether the LDS Church's current response to scholarship follows a pattern of other churches in the past. I'd have to think about that. I think that one of the unique things about Mormonism is that it's going to be a group outside the mainstream that is nonetheless large enough to be drawing serious study. That in addition has a large amount of documents and a mechanism for controlling them. Let's also say this. So there's a church organization to do that sort of thing. I don't think that, for example, I don't know. I have to think about that more. I don't think that the same situation has arisen a lot of times in the past.
Just a little context. The comment where Robert Millett and Richard Bushman were talking at that Library of Congress deconstruction event, part of the background of that was there was a scholar at the conference who, between sessions, kind of pulled over Robert Millett to the side. He says, you know, I think Mormons right today are where Protestant or evangelical Christians were 25 years ago. Just in that beginning stage of, again, like I said, putting your positions out there in argument form and starting to get it. So that's just a little bit of background where he felt like we were like following them 24 years ago. But I do think Seth is right in that we have a centralized authority, and really these Salt Lake guys versus this diffuse, you know, I mean, there is certainly some authoritarian bodies and other ones. But in some ways, I think we're going to be unique in the sense that we try to control everything from one spot. John Charles.
One thing that I think is helpful to think about, I mean, in terms of hierarchies, church hierarchies that want to control access to information, control scholarship, Catholicism would be another analog to look at, particularly earlier in the 20th century, pre-Vatican II. The other analog to look at, though, and this is where I think Mormonism is kind of unique, lots of new religious movements are often very closety about getting scholars access to them and to their sources and their materials. But what's interesting is that in those cases, it's invariably outsiders who are coming into study. What's different about Mormonism is that you have this institution that's kind of closety about its resources, but is able to produce insiders who are able to go out and talk about the movement. And that is a very interesting dynamic.
Yeah. Interesting. Was there a question? No. But no, I think that's great.
I had the impression that you were distressed at the Library of Congress program by the last two speakers and the juxtapositioning what seemed to be a rather scholarly approach and a rather evangelistic approach back to back. I actually find that one of the more interesting aspects of the conference that they did this, because I don't know that the conference was necessarily designed to be an exercise in academia. It was, I think, perhaps broader than that. And it seemed to me like to have those positions back to back would be very enlightening. And I'm wondering if you truly were. Did I misunderstand it? You found that distressing? Why did you find it distressing?
I think you didn't misunderstand. I was absolutely distressed. I think that what bothered me was the session was titled was about Davies' paper, and it was very far from any sort of well, as we're talking before, it was way over here in sociology and anthropology, and the response was over here in ethics and theology. I don't think that juxtaposition drew anything out because they were talking completely past each other. I mean, what Davies said was, if the church wants to be a world, and he defined world religion as opposed to global religion. Global religion, he basically meant the church may have offices in different places and be setting up franchises, but is not cultured in the place where it is. So the Catholic Church is, for example, a world religion because it feels very local at the places where it is. And then the response was that that's not possible. And it's not possible because of this singular revealed truth. And there's really just no sense for me that as a scholar going in there, that there's something to get out of that exchange, where there's just the other's the end of it. The answer is just no. I mean, in scholarship, the answer is never just no, and that's how it felt there that day.
Well, I think it's interesting that they were there and that far apart.
Okay.
Just that they were present in the same room.
Sure.
Expressing those points of view, not for each other's benefit so much as for everybody you who were there.
Thank you.
Like a valid conference.
I'll go ahead and out who this final speaker is. You can buy the proceedings, but it's Roger Keller at BYU, who is a former Presbyterian minister, and whose major conversion was based on the idea that he didn't really have authority, you know, as a Presbyterian minister, and all of a sudden he did. And so his big thing was, we have the authority, and because other churches don't claim that way, and he talked about how we now have the 7th and 8th Quorum of 70, and we have basically general authorities and people led from Salt Lake, but who live in the different regions, that sort of what Douglas Davies was arguing is that just naturally the culture of the place will sort of take it and adapt it and change it, and he was just basically arguing that it wouldn't. So I agree with you that in some ways it's a very interesting thing because you did learn something about Mormonism that these two, you know, I think you're right too, but I also agree with him that as a scholar, basically he shut down further conversation or elaboration on Douglas Davies's.
I happen personally not to enjoy very much the last presentation there, and I'm in agreement with Seth on that. It's just, I think it was an interesting... Okay.
Yeah. No, you're right. It was an interesting snapshot of where Mormonism is right now, etc. But as somebody who wanted to get into Douglas Davies and really explore those, it was a conversation closer.
And I have to say, I'm in agreement. And when Davies asked the question that he did, and I think that one question may go down as the most memorable line from the entire conference. And I found myself almost clapping, and I'm just sitting there by myself listening because I thought to myself the same thing. What are we doing here? Because it definitely didn't feel like an academic conference at that point. So I'm wholeheartedly there with that concern. But I also found myself saying, this is the first time, or maybe second or third time, this has ever happened. And so from the standpoint of the fact that it was happening at all, and that step that is... you know, maybe two or three steps on a very, hopefully a very long road ahead in the academic study of Mormonism. From that standpoint, I had to say, I'm glad this happened at all. Right. So.
John?
Comment on this current tying in Gene England's
idea, if I understand him correctly, that the gospel is only as true as the church, or the church is as true as the gospel, that interpretation cannot be avoided, and that no matter what kind of truth is revealed, humans are dealing with it, and it will change, or the interpretation or the presentation of it will change over time. And my impression is that the respondent, whose name I didn't quite catch, to Mr. Davies, was seeing that as somewhat of a threat.
The comment for the tape was just that, the last line, I think you said it, was that he sensed that Roger Keller's response was seeing an approach like Douglas Davies's as a threat in some ways. And I think you're probably right. Yeah. So, Mike.
I'll have to disagree with the position that Dan took, that this is a form of dialogue that Mormon studies will happily outgrow one day. I don't see that as occurring for the primary reason that, unlike other traditions where this dialogue has become non-polemical, that transition has occurred in traditions that are not proselytizing traditions. It has occurred in Catholicism because Catholicism is not a proselytizing tradition. It has occurred with the Quakers, it has occurred with Judaism, it has occurred in many religious traditions which are not actively proselytizing. I think what will occur is that the dialogue will not be so ham-fisted on the side of the proselytizing, on the proselytizing side. And I did not attend the Washington seminar, but I was at the one at Yale, Mormon Theology Conference at Yale. And what stunned me about I only attended one of the two full days, but the second full day, what stunned me was that all of the BYU speakers were speaking as if they were in Sunday school, because the audience was full of divinity students and full of members of the Yale Divinity School, of faculty members from history, from sociology, from anthropology, and speaker after speaker from BYU were using terms like "we believe," "our church," speaking to the audience as if everyone in the audience was Mormon. That ham-fisted sense of inclusiveness only for Mormons is going to change. But I don't think the essential dialogue between a proselytizing academic community and a strictly analytical academic community is going to change. We're not going to outgrow that as long as Mormonism is avidly proselytizing.
I'm more inclined to with the negative assessment at least how it might happen. I do think it will. I don't think it will be quite as comfortable. I'll just say that.
My way of responding to that would be, at least when you say I disagree, Dan. I agree with Seth, though, that the church, what I was really saying there is I think the church will be less invested in who gets hired here at Claremont, who gets hired at Utah State, Emory, or wherever things might happen in the future. I think right now when Claremont expressed interest, immediately there were BYU people signing up to be on this council because there was this sense that they might have some input here. And so I think the Yale Conference is a great example, and the evolution between the Yale Conference to the Library of Congress was a better conference because it was less ham-fisted, like you say. I think the future will be there. And again, I sense that what you saw at Yale, I really think Robert Millett and some of these other guys saw as well. And they're learning, they're growing, and so I think that's right. But my real response was to really the line in Seth's paper where he says, we'll have to get past this point where anybody thinks Mormon studies, when they think of it, that's, oh, Mormons studying themselves for them, etc. And I think scholars, more and more scholars like Seth, will take over. And that's what I was really agreeing to. So.
Well, thank you. We're over time, so we'll end here. But thank you, Seth. Thanks again.
And the next session right in this very room is about Mormonism and how it's taught in the academy. And